make the product high quality, you know, make good on your promises of everything that that customer was expecting to receive leading up to that opening of the envelope that, that they get in the mail. Mm-hmm. And the rest is, you know, inconsequential if your product is something that, that she loves or that he loves or that they love. So yeah, I think we can trick ourselves sometimes into thinking some things are important.
Welcome to the Women Choosing Growth podcast, where we bring you practical advice and guidance on how to grow your business and achieve success in your entrepreneurial journey. We feature inspiring stories of success, challenges of growth, and lessons learned from women entrepreneurs, industry experts, and thought leaders who have been through the growing pains inevitable as an entrepreneur. Whether you are just getting started or are looking to scale up your business, our show is designed to provide you with the tools, resources, and community you need to grow your business. Join your host, Tina, a lifelong entrepreneur and business growth advisor, as we explore topics such as marketing, sales, finance, leadership, and personal growth, all tailored specifically to the needs of women entrepreneurs. So if you're ready to grow your business faster and smarter and learn from the experiences of those who have traveled the growth path before you, then this podcast is for you. Thanks for tuning in and let's get started.
Welcome back to another episode, ladies. Today we have Marnie Rabovich-Konski, and she is the founder and CEO of Thigh Society, and an undergarment brand specializing in moisture-wicking, lightweight, and breathable boxer briefs for women. Marnie is one of those unique entrepreneurs who identified a white space opportunity based on her personal pain point, which was thigh rub. She pioneered this new long leg underwear category for women to help with chafing, butt sweat, modesty, and overall comfort. Without any related experience in business, retail, sales, manufacturing, e-commerce, none of the above, she still followed her hunch, quit her full-time pension job at the age of 40, and bootstrapped Thigh Society to over $20 million in revenue in sales currently, with $50 million on the horizon. Thigh Society has been featured on the Today Show, in Self Magazine, Oprah Daily, and is loved by customers worldwide, including myself. Marnie has been featured in Forbes Magazine, NASDAQ, and several other notable publications and podcasts, including Women Choosing Growth. With that, I am super excited to have Marnie here today. Marnie, you have said businesses don't need more products. They just need to know their true customer and provide what that customer wants. So basically, less is more. Welcome to the show.
Thanks so much for having me.
I am super excited to dive into this very important topic, talking all about product businesses, and you're going to share what product businesses should and shouldn't do. So ladies, get a pen handy, be ready to take some notes. She has some amazing insight. But before we get into the meats of that, I really want to hear about your entrepreneur journey, because I absolutely love your business. As a thigh girl myself, the very first time I saw one of your ads, I'm like, this lady is speaking directly to me. So you're obviously doing things right with your audience, me being one of them. But you didn't just wake up one day and be this amazing brand. So tell us about your entrepreneur journey and how you got here today.
Sure. So it's been a 15-year journey, and that's 15. I started the business, I had the idea for the business in 2008, and I had the idea for a product of this nature in 2008. And really, it's one of those classic entrepreneur stories of I had an idea for a product I needed, but couldn't find on the market. Mm-hmm. And I have always had thighs, and the thighs have changed shape over the years, depending on my weight. But regardless of my weight, and we'll come back to why this is important later, regardless of my weight, my thighs have always touched, and I've always experienced what we call thigh chafing in hot weather. And that is when skin on skin is rubbing together and there's sweat, and the friction causes a rash to emerge between your legs, and it's extremely painful. It makes it very difficult to walk bare-legged in warm weather. And so I've always struggled with this issue, and in 2008, I was looking for a long-leg women's underwear that wasn't shapewear, because I think shapewear is great. I think there's a time and place for it. I own a few pieces of shapewear, and there's certain dresses that I feel really comfortable wearing shapewear underneath, but when I think about the maxi dresses that I love to wear in the summer and the flowy dresses and skirts, I really was looking for something that was lightweight, cooling, breathable, seamless, that was the next best thing to going bare-legged. So I set out to look for something like that in the summer of 2008 and could not find anything. So I started asking some friends. I started knocking on doors in Toronto, where I'm based out of, on some local bra-fitting specialty boutiques and big department stores. And much to my surprise, there was literally nothing made in my size. The suggestions were wear men's underwear, cut your pantyhose, cut your leggings. How about putting on a deodorant or powder? And I had tried all that before, actually. And I guess I'm a sweaty, sweaty girl because that's powders and gels, you know, yeah, right here.
Like we're always in her hands.
Yeah. Especially during perimenopause, right here. Totally was just, you know, those creams and gels were annoying. They had to be reapplied and they weren't a solution for me. And then men's underwear weren't a solution because they had extra fabric around the crotch area for, you know, men's parts that I didn't need. And they weren't necessarily thoughtfully designed for what I was trying to do, right? The material was sometimes 100% cotton, which is very absorbent, not a solution to prevent rashes. And it just wasn't what I was looking for. And the only things I could find online were either shapewear or companies that were making size 18 plus, and making it seem like these anti-chafe shorts were only for plus size people. And I knew that not to be true. And I was really, you know, angry actually that there was a stigma around a perfectly normal skin condition of sweating between your legs. You know, we all put on deodorant, or most of us put on deodorant in the morning because we don't want to sweat and we don't have BO. So where's the shame in needing to wear a little shorty underneath your skirts and dresses for comfort and modesty and, you know, moisture wicking and all of that? So I was completely clueless. I was 32 years old. I had no experience in retail, manufacturing, e-commerce, marketing. My background was working in a bunch of different, you know, large consulting organizations at in academia and for the provincial government here in Canada.
Okay.
Doing very unrelated things to any of the areas I just mentioned. So I think ignorance is bliss. I did not know what I was getting into. But I decided that I was curious enough to figure out how could I make this designer shorty underwear of my dreams? And maybe a few people would want to buy it. You know, I set aside some money. I did quit my job, which is, I will stop for a second and clarify that I never recommend that people quit their jobs to pursue entrepreneurship. And this was very uncharacteristic of me and very short-lived. I quit because I was coming up on 2 years in this job in the government. And to be quite honest, it just wasn't my speed. I felt like I had made a good contribution in 2 years, but I was looking for something more akin to my private sector experience. So I quit and took a few months off to spend time learning essentially about how to be an entrepreneur in e-commerce and in retail manufacturing. So I sought out people in my network who could help me learn about the garment trade. I was, you know, digging into research about what Shopify was, which at the time it was just a payment processor. Now we know it to be, you know, quite a huge e-commerce enterprise. But at the time, I had to find a developer to help me learn how to use WordPress and help me come up with a website. I also networked with a bunch of factories, or I actually connected with a fashion, not-for-profit fashion enterprise here in Toronto that had a guidebook on about 25 different local manufacturing partners that I could speak to, where I went knocking on doors and said, hey, I have an idea. I need, could we bring this to life? And I'll skip through a lot of it because it was about a 6 month period that it took to come up with our first prototype. But really it was about getting creative, sourcing fabric from local fabric importers and working with ultimately a couple of manufacturing partners to come up with a prototype that I liked, and then iterating on that and testing that with people in focus groups and whatnot. So that took a full year until we finally went live, which in hindsight, a year was quite fast. And I think it was because I was devoted to it a little more full time. But during that halfway mark through that first year, I did go back into the workforce and I stayed there for 7 years. So I worked a full-time job as an MBA career coach at a big university here in Toronto. And I was growing and working on Thigh Society in my spare time for 7 years. Basically, you know, building the product line out, launching with two basic products, and ultimately slowly expanding, which I'm sure we'll get into. So you know, I really took my time. I was a really risk averse person. I liked my income. I quit my full-time job at 40 years old, which I think, you know, speaks a lot to my personality, which is I had been working on the business part-time for 7 years. And finally at 40 said, you know what? I have a good career behind me. If this doesn't work full-time, I can always go back into the corporate world and find something else to do. So mm-hmm. we are now 7 years, almost 8 years after I quit that full-time job, working on ThighSlidey full-time now for 8 years. So 15 total. So it's been a long road.
A long road. I love the fact that you're teaching MBA students at the same time that you're like literally building your first enterprise business.
Exactly. Yeah. They inspired me so much, my students. Here they were making all these crazy, amazing career changes. And I was sitting in my office thinking, okay, well, when am I going to make mine? Right. And so I think ultimately that influenced my decision for sure.
Yes. I love that journey. And I think it's really important to double down on the fact that you don't just come up with a product, go get a patent, and it's out in the market in six months. Like there's a whole process. Like you don't want to do it that quick.
And you know what? I would say to something I glossed over, but I did have some conversations with some patent lawyers very early on. So I was lucky to have a friend's husband who was a patent lawyer. So he gave me some free advice. And essentially he was like, does this really make sense for you to get a patent on this undergarment? What are you going to be able to actually patent? And will you be able to defend that? Are you prepared to spend all of the money in legal fees? And that was really an eye-opener for me because I didn't understand what it meant to get something patented or trademarked at that time early on. And, you know, I think if I had invested in a patent, which we don't have, I really am not sure it would have made a difference. I think it would have been a costly mistake ultimately because people can change. Any bad actor can change a stitch, you know, or some thread or a waistband hem length and argue that they're not infringing on your patent. So who's going to win in that situation? Only the lawyers that are getting paid to defend. Mm-hmm. So a lot of people think it's necessary all the time. And I don't think it is. In some cases, it definitely is. If you have something really proprietary, but not all cases does it make sense to have a patent.
That's good advice. Mm. Absolutely.
Yeah.
Well, let's start to talk about we're going to share today what the product business is, because most everyone listening, if they have a product business, they're already established for the most part.
Yep.
So as you obviously have 15 years worth of experience of what to do and what not to do. Sure. And so that's what you're going to share today. Let's start out with what people should do when they're in a product business. And this would also apply to businesses that have a service and some kind of product side mm-hmm. to it. Mm-hmm. So what are those things that you would highlight and say, absolutely do these if you have any kind of product in your company?
So I think if you have a product-based business, I think the first thing you have to do is to be able to show your value proposition to your customers and to be able to explain very clearly and succinctly what the use cases are that your product is going to solve, because it's a crowded market out there. The world mm-hmm. doesn't need more products. What we need are solutions to problems, right? And oftentimes I think most new products that we see aren't necessarily this eureka moment of something brand new. It's an iteration on something that already exists in the market that's just slightly tweaked to solve a pain point for the customer mm-hmm. demographic that it's trying to address. And so I think it's really important to be crystal clear and to explain over and over again to your customers through your advertising, through your marketing, through your socials, what is the value add that your product's going to offer? What solution are you there to solve? Because I think we can get really invested in our brands as a founder. You know, we all have mission statements, we all have values, we have some sort of difference that we're looking to make in the world, but it's a crowded marketplace out there for mind share and for eyeballs, right? We're all users of social media. We all know how much time we spend scrolling our Instagram feed or Facebook or TikTok. You know, our attention span is very small and very short. So it's really about how are you going to speak to your customer and get her or him or them to pay attention to your ad and, you know, click on it to learn more. How are you going to get them to give their email address to you so you can start targeting them in email? How are you going to get them to make a purchase? And I think part of that, and this is something we were talking about in our earlier conversation, is I think how you price your product is really important, because everything I just talked about was around paid spend and paid marketing. You, in this world today, I think a lot of people don't understand how cash intensive a product-based business can be in e-commerce. You've got your inventory costs that you need to put up, pay up front to order your products. And then you need to put aside a significant chunk of money for marketing costs. I think, you know, one of the things brands should do is put themselves in the shoes of being in a direct response marketing angle rather than being in brand marketing. So what do we mean by that? Mm-hmm. When you think about brand marketing, I think of glossy images, pretty pictures, evoking emotions. I think about something like Nike's campaign, Just Do It, where they're bringing in, you know, celebrity athletes and they're doing these incredibly, you know, moving campaigns. That's amazing, but most of us already know who Nike is. Like, Nike doesn't need to do a job to educate its customer base who they are, because we already know who they are. But when you're a product-based business that doesn't have that established brand name recognition in the market, you're in the business of direct response marketing. You're in the business of eliciting a response in the form of a click to get your customers to show interest in you, right? And so mm-hmm. once you strip away all the frills that come with brand marketing, you really have to get down to the basics of, I need to spend money, I need to allocate money towards my paid marketing and building my email list. Because it's not just about brand awareness. Brand awareness is great, but brand awareness doesn't translate to sales necessarily. So for product businesses starting out, it's not a situation in which people are just going to flock and find your website. Like, we know this already. I know that your audience is quite established already. So, you know, we all face that reality of like that moment where we make our website live and it's like, you can't just sit there and wait for traffic to arrive on your site.
Refreshing your Google Analytics.
Yeah, we're going to be sitting there for a long time, you know, and I think there's a lot of noise out there. Unfortunately, there's a lot of agencies and e-commerce businesses that are trying to sell founders on the next big thing. They're trying to, there's so many big shiny objects out there. You know, I call it big shiny object syndrome. And I was guilty of that for many mm-hmm. years of like, oh my gosh, we have to put a loyalty program in and we have to spend money on SEO and we have to work on our blog. And, you know, you can get so distracted by all of the different messages that these different, you know, agencies in the marketplace are telling you should do, that it's very difficult to do all of those things at any one given point in time. And it's difficult to do them well. So we're all about getting back to the basics, focusing on what is going to drive revenue for the business. And, you know, we like to say that even, you know, SEO was for me a personal thing that I thought was so important in my business. And my CMO who said, no business that is doing less than $5 million in sales should be spending a dime on SEO, because it is a crowded marketplace out there. And SEO is the idea of putting in keywords and paying, you know, spending some money to optimize your brand showing up in keyword searches. But your competitors could have really deep pockets and they're spending more money than you'll ever be able to afford on bidding for certain keywords. So their paid advertising, you know, spend on their keywords are always going to rank higher than yours on Google. So as a small business, is that really where your dollars are best spent? Probably not. Probably not until you get to a certain point. So mm-hmm. what you can do is areas within your control, which are trying to find your audience and honing in on the messages that are going to attract that audience. So that means spending money and allocating money towards creative testing on advertising. And we were talking about this, you and I, a little bit earlier, where what we do at Thigh Society is we come up with different creative in our ads. We come up with different images. We test images. And we keep the copy consistent. We see what the winning image is, and the winning image is determined by how many people click on the ad. And, mm-hmm. you know, this may be basic for some of your listeners, but I know some people may be hiring agencies. These are good questions to ask the agency or media buyers that you're working with, is what is their process around meta ads? Are they doing creative testing to learn and iterate on the best messages that are going to translate to clicks to email, so email subscribes, and ultimately to purchase? So we test ads against each other with creative, we test with copy, and we're constantly looking for new use cases to remind our customer why she needs us in her life. Because again, we're not trying to necessarily be, you know, a memorable name, Thigh Society. We want someone to see our ads and say, thigh chafing, butt sweat, hot flashes, yes, I can relate to that. I need a product that's going to help solve that problem for me. And she's going to click. And then once we gain her trust through a few ads, or we, you know, welcome her into our email flow, you know, hopefully she makes a purchase eventually. But all of our traffic is driven ultimately from paid marketing, from paid spend. And it all starts from an ad. So it's a little bit of a round circle way to get to come back to what I was saying. But I think it's easy to get distracted by shiny object syndrome. You know, you can do a lot of things for your business at any point in time, and not all of them are going to move the needle. So define for you what's the most important. For us at Thigh Society, profitability is important. Return on ad spend is important. You know, we're a fully bootstrapped company. You know, we're a $20 million business and we haven't raised a cent. I've never raised a penny of capital, and that's been by design for me. Maybe that's not what someone else who was leading this kind of company would do. But I think, you know, now as I think about it, what are some actions that product-based business owners can follow is stay true to yourself as well. Mm-hmm. You know, we're going to talk a lot about the customer angle, but stay true to yourself. What do you want out of your business? Are you looking, you know, are you looking for time freedom, location freedom, financial freedom, all of those things? All right, well, you know, is your product-based business, if you take on investors and raise capital, how much, you know, time freedom are you going to have? You're going to be beholden to certain targets and, you know, certain expectations because you owe your investors answers all the time. If that's not what you want to be doing, maybe you grow your business a little bit slower. Maybe you focus in on, you know, on a certain niche and you hold off on some product expansion that you may have been thinking you wanted to do. Maybe it's not that important in the short term. So for me, that's been, you know, it sounds a bit cliche, but staying true to yourself, I think, has really worked for me. We are still a single product business after all these years. And I didn't listen to a lot of the advice I had early on from people telling me, if you're in a product-based business, you better keep having newness for your customers to keep buying from you. And I thought to myself, well, I think there's a lot of customers that need this product, and I'd like to get input from my customers about what they'd like as product extensions, but I also don't want to be everything to everyone. I have a very clear idea of what I want this product to be, and I want to hear from my customers about what they want and what they like, and I want to keep reaching new customers. And so over time, that's allowed us to become really good at what we do in our niche. So we only do shorts. You know, I expanded from the beginning of having two colors to multiple colors. Now we have colorways in every style. We have four styles, four fabrics, not just one fabric. We've got different sizes. I was able to increase my size range over time. So as a product-based business, you can say no to some of the advice that you receive from other people who may be operating from a very traditional retail playbook, but who may have had their career history in wholesale, for example, and not really been enmeshed in the world of e-commerce. So, you know, I think it's important just to be, you know, to trust in yourself and in what you're seeing and observing in your own business, to know that not everybody has, everybody's going to have advice for you and not everybody has the right advice.
Oh, yeah. Entrepreneurship comes with a lot of other people's opinions, right?
Yeah. And there's a bit of luck to it too, right? There, no one has a crystal ball. But I do think there's so many people out there that are trying to get their, you know, trying to make their mark in terms of having an agency that has a certain product or service, or they're an expert in email marketing, or an expert in SEO, or expert in blogging. And, you know, the truth is that, yes, there are definitely experts out there, but only you know what's right for your business, you know, at any given point in time. And you have a right to spend that money where you want. And you have a right to say no. It's not, you're not necessarily missing out by not doing certain things at certain stages in your business. There's a right time for right things to happen. And you don't need to do everything at once. As much as all of the direct-to-consumer marketing newsletters and podcasts might suggest that you should be trying to do all of this at once, it's never been
less
is more. Keep it simple, stupid. The KISS principle is what we follow here. And it works, you know, it works.
Yeah. I want to come back to a couple that you hit on some great things there of what product businesses should do. Yeah. One of the first things you mentioned was pricing, and you shared some examples of what pricing is.
Yeah.
One piece that I know you know, but didn't mention is like even the cost of trial and error, right? like that needs to be part of the budget and the plan, because I'm sure you're, like you said, your first material wasn't the one that you wanted. Now you have several, mm-hmm. but there's a lot of money that goes into testing the products that need to be part of that plan.
Definitely. Yes. And I think our first products, just to clarify, the first fabrics we used were quite good, actually. I really liked them. And a lot of customers did too. They were made of a bamboo spandex, stretchy fabric. They were beautiful and soft, but they had some elastic waistband included in them. And they had a few seams. And over time, as I started to learn about innovations in fabric technology and fabric manufacturing, I became aware of a new form of manufacturing called seamless knitting, where you're essentially picking yarns, throwing them into a machine, and the machine spits out a tube of fabric that you can then cut and sew and make into a short. That's my very short version of how we make our.
I like that. Yeah. It's visual.
Yeah, it's visual. If you ever have worn like a bandeau, stretchy bandeau top underneath like a bralette, it comes from the same machines that we use for our shorties. And it ultimately, you know, leads to a better stretch. It fits more bodies better. It's less waste because you're actually producing exactly how much you need. So as opposed to like cutting and sewing out of a pattern where you're, you know, losing a lot of fabric to waste in that process, we're just cutting to make. But yeah, you have to set aside money to make mistakes. And, you know, you have to price your product in a way that's going to allow you to scale. And I think this is probably the number one conversation I have with founders, which is, you know, don't price your product too low. And, you know, you may have a product that other competitors may emerge and have their own. You may be iterating on something in the market that already exists, but you're not trying to compete with the Walmarts of the world and their cheap and cheerful imitation of whatever it is you're making. And so leaving yourself enough room in your margins by having your prices high enough to factor in all of your cost of goods, you know, including your shipping costs, is really critical. And I think people often, it's a hard pill to swallow because shipping costs can be really expensive. Never mind the cost of materials, you know, ideally over time, as your business hopefully grows and scales, you can negotiate, you know, minimum order quantity discounts with your partners to lower that cost of goods. You know, you may go offshore, find cheaper materials or, you know, partners that you can negotiate better with to lower that cost. But shipping costs are one of those things where, you know, it's easy to overlook. And I see this more in businesses that are really just getting started, where their founders are really excited about the end experience for the customer receiving the product. And I get it. We're all online shoppers. There's nothing more exciting than getting a package at your door, right? A brand you've never heard of before, and you're so excited to like rip it open and see what it looks like. And as much as that experience is important, and of course, you know, the whole unboxing phenomenon and all of those videos.
Yes.
That's great and that's exciting, but you know, how much is that costing you? And how is that worth it? How much does your customer care? Like, can you still have a really great experience by using lighter packaging, less of it, you know, or packaging that's recycled, something that makes the customer feel good that you're not a brand that's, you know, adding to the already, you know, very wasteful consumerist, you know, industry that we all participate in. Mm-hmm. You know, I think now it's getting better, but yeah, factoring in that you can still provide your customer with an excellent experience end to end that doesn't involve these very over the top, you know, unboxing experiences, because that cost comes back to you as a business and your goal is probably to be profitable. So don't think that you can't scale back. I think there's a lot of fallacy that we believe as founders, being so close and intimate with our businesses, that we can't fathom making changes. Like, no, like my customer's going to miss that box that came in, or that tissue paper. Like, what is she going to think if it comes in?
The custom stickers.
Yeah, the custom stickers. You know what? I don't care. Make the product high quality, you know, make good on your promises of everything that customer was expecting to receive leading up to that opening of the envelope that they get in the mail. Mm-hmm. And the rest is, you know, inconsequential if your product is something that she loves or that he loves or that they love. So yeah, I think we can trick ourselves sometimes into thinking some things are important. Don't get me wrong. I love a good brand experience, but thinking practically on dollars and cents, you know, it can add up, especially at scale.
Are you an accomplished woman business owner with a story to tell? Do you crave a platform where you can share your journey, the good, the bad, and the ugly? Hey everyone, it's Tina here. If you're fans of the show, then you know we are a show that celebrates the strengths and resilience of women entrepreneurs just like you. As we're getting this podcasting community going, I thought it would be fitting to extend an invitation to apply to join me as a guest on our Top 100 podcast platform. I started Women Choosing Growth because I believe that real growth happens when we come together and share our expertise and our experiences. We want to hear your inspiring stories, the challenges you face, and the lessons you've learned on your entrepreneur journey. Whether you've triumphed over adversity or faced setbacks head on, your story has the power to inspire and empower other women just like you. This platform is for you to showcase your achievements, highlight your expertise, and create meaningful connections within our community. So if you're a fearless woman business owner, unafraid to open up about your path to success, we want you on our show. Go to www.womenchoosinggrowth.com and join our community. From there, you'll be given the chance to fill out the short application. If you believe that you have a story to share, then why not? Once again, it's www.womenchoosinggrowth.com. I can't wait to feature more amazing and talented women in this community. Now, back to the show.
That's funny because I literally think the same thing of when I get something that I'm not expecting to have, like fancy packaging. As an entrepreneur, I'm like, how much could I have paid for that if they didn't spend so much on the darn boxing or whatever? Yeah. And honestly, when you open a package that isn't fancy, you don't think about it. For me personally, I only think about it when it is over the top, like when I get something that is over the top. But like if my product just comes in a plastic bag, it's perfectly fine. I don't think twice about it. I go put the thing on or use the thing, whatever it is. I don't think about the packaging unless it's over the top. And then I think, I just spent so much money.
How much did I spend on that? Yeah, totally.
Exactly.
And I mean, something else I think I skipped over is, you know, like I did gloss over this at the beginning, but pricing your product high enough, especially if you're in, you know, maybe you're in a niche business or maybe you want to position your product as premium. As a business owner, I think it's important to try to steer away from conditioning your customer to expect discounts from you. And we all like a deal as much as the next person. But conditioning your customer to purchase on a discount isn't going to help you in the long run. And we all know those big brands out there where we don't buy from them unless it's a 30% off sale. And we come to expect those sales every few weeks. Some brands I can think of used to offer them at least twice a week. So, you know, you'd be a fool to order anything at full price because you'd know that the brand was just going to offer it on promotion, you know, 2 days later. And I think, you know, your customers, deliver on the value that your product offers. And you don't have to be a discount-based or a promotion-based brand. You can continue to remind that customer what your value is and why they should feel good about paying full price. That's not to say you should never offer sales. I think it's great to offer a welcome discount, which is, you know, a fair exchange to ask someone to give their email address to you. It's always good practice to give them a small discount on their first purchase. And maybe you have a couple of sales during the year, but I think it's tempting to see what other brands are doing. And often when I see smaller brands that are continuously on promotion, I think, oh no, like they're probably not doing that well if they have to keep offering discounts. So price your products in a way that can allow you to be profitable and also, you know, stick to the value that you bring without needing to promote them constantly.
Right. There's some big brands that never do any pricing adjustments or any discounts. So let's be part of that.
Yeah. And I think we were just talking about this before the call. You don't see, you know, we think of Thigh Society as a premium brand. You know, our underwear are $39, you know, which are not exorbitant, but you know, they're still, for some people that is considered still a splurge on a pair of underwear. And we think of it like if, you know, you never see discounts from Chanel. Chanel doesn't have a sale every year. Louis Vuitton, Gucci, they don't go on promotion and no one says boo about it. So why can't your brand not go on promotion?
And they're following the same less is more. You walk into those stores, there's only a few products that they have.
Right? They're only doing a few drops a season and it's very limited edition. And for sure.
Yes. I think,
why not? Why not be good at something and keep doing
it? Be the Louis Vuitton of your brand.
I love that. Yeah.
I I think what biggest things that we like, all the little advice that you're giving here today are very impactful, but I'm seeing that really people need to have a very good strategy on their pricing and a very good, very detailed strategy on their marketing. Because those are the two things, like make sure your margins are in line, have a plan for all the things, all the costs that go into it, a couple promotions a year if you're doing that, whatever. And then also a really good strategy on the marketing, because shiny things in marketing are all over the place.
And it's the execution of that that matters, right? Like knowing, I mean, this seems like obvious advice, but I think founders need to be generalists. I think founders need to know a little bit about every aspect of their business to be dangerous. A little bit about finance, a little bit about ops, a little bit about marketing, you know, a little bit about customer service. You can outsource to experts the details of that, but enough to be dangerous to be able to ask the right questions of people that you're bringing on as fractionals, you know, fractional CFO or CMO or marketing partner, to really just ensure that these partners that you're going to be working with, or team members, employees, whatever your team structure looks like, can execute on your vision. And sometimes, you know, I'm the first to raise my hand and say that I take my vision from my CFO and CMO. They've come forward with ideas that were better than mine and that made a lot more sense. Or I may have been a little skeptical at the beginning and said, you know, fine, I'll give you a budget, prove it to me. And the data proved that their approach was more sound than something I would have, you know, came up with. So
those are the people you want on your team for sure.
Hire people that are smarter than you. Hiring people that are smarter than you. I know what my strengths are and I know what my weaknesses are, and I cannot try to be an expert at everything, but I do try to know a little bit about enough that I can ask some questions that'll get me, you know, to at least hire the right people and at least ask the right questions. But I think you nailed it with the, I think, pricing and marketing execution. You cannot, in a product-based business these days, do anything without paid spend. You can't. You know, I think it's easy to get caught up and swept up into the media headlines of, you know, brands that go viral overnight and sell through their entire inventory. You know, or back in the day where you were on Oprah's list of favorite things and like brands would sell out overnight. Like, it's a very different landscape right now in e-commerce. You know, even, you know, to speak for a minute about like the Oprah example, you know, a lot of media online now is pay to play. It's all about affiliate programs and where these, you know, big media corporations want to get a slice of the pie. They want to get a commission off of each, you know, purchase. So, you know, for us, that's been great. After we had reached a certain revenue point, we did start to invest in an affiliate program. That's been really helpful for us. I think we could have done it a little sooner, but we just didn't have the resources to go ahead and do it. And that's an easy way again, and makes more sense for you to have that premium pricing in place, because with affiliates, you're sharing, you know, you're giving some of that profit away.
It goes back to that margins.
Goes right back financial to plan. Margins. Exactly. So leaving room for that spend, that, you know, you may want to incorporate some new marketing. The trial and error that you talked about, we're testing direct marketing through direct mail, leaving budget aside for the tests that you want and are going to need to do as time goes on, because you can't put all your eggs in the Meta and Google basket, even though that's what they want us to do. You do own your email channels, which is should be a huge source of revenue for you, but how are you going to get those emails, right? You got to pay upfront to get some of them. So,
I like having the strategy for both the planning, well, for any strategy that you're building, because that gives you the guardrails too. Like, you can change your strategy. You should be looking at your strategy every few months.
For sure.
But at least in that meantime, when that shiny thing comes in, you'd be like, no, because this is our plan currently for whatever period of time. Like, let's add that to the whiteboard to see if we're going to put that in next quarter's marketing plan or whatever the case is, because I've seen that so often. Entrepreneurs are like, oh, I saw this new thing viral, you know, and everyone's doing X. It's like, no, actually everyone's not. How the algorithms work. Once you look for one thing, you've got like feeds full of the whatever it is. I love written plans, because it gives you those guardrails to like this is what we're doing. We're going to play with this. We're going to strategize this. We're going to test these things, costs, whatever.
Yeah. I think that's such a great point, and I'm really glad you brought it up, because my CFO and my CMO and I, we do our budgeting together every year, and we go line by line by line.
I love it.
For every single item of spend. And you could have been my CMO just now talking to me, where I come sometimes and try to sneak in like a, hey, I saw this great idea that this other brand is doing and we should try that. And she, you know, she's like, you have a little kitty. We could take it out of your budget if you'd like, but not coming out of my budget, because my plans are already in place and we've got, you know, already tactics and plans in place to execute on the budget that I have. So I think, you know, it's, and that's, I love the push and pull that we have. I think in Thigh Society, I think it's important that I can listen to my CMO and respect what she has to say. And I can be pushed back, you know, as founders, sometimes we can let our egos get in the way and think that we know better. And I am always ready to eat humble pie and say, listen, I brought these people on because they know more than I do. I'm just here to bring some ideas to the table and let's talk about them. And I can be talked off the ledge, you know, or convinced to abandon ship if I'm given a good reason. But yeah, it is, it's important for founders to understand the line items on the budgeting, you know, and to understand why certain dollars were allocated certain ways. And just to be able sometimes to, how do I phrase this? Like, to not be married to ideas. You can't be so passionately married to some ideas, because some fail, right? I can think of a few marketing examples that we had such high hopes for, and we were so convinced that they were going to crush it, and they bombed, like, and they bombed hard, right? And
the thing you think is going viral, like, gets crickets.
Yeah, crickets and money, like, set on fire, you know? Like, that was a total waste. And it hurts, but you know, you take that under your belt and you move forward and, you know, you try again with something else, but
live and learn.
And hopefully that budget was allocated because you knew it was a test budget.
Test budget. Yes.
Test budget, which is something we do. You allocate, you know, a certain amount for test budget where you're testing new things and you don't necessarily have any expectations to tie the results of those efforts into your overall ROAS, your return on your ad spend or your investment. I think it's important to do that, because then once you test, if you do find those winners, then you can fold them into your overall plan.
Yep. And if it's a true test budget, you're kind of planning that it somewhat will work. Because so if it works, it's actually bonus. Whereas like if it bombs, like you said, that was part of what could have been the plan.
It's potentially
running out the door.
Right. But better that it was part, that it was separate from your overall plan. It didn't distract you and just didn't, and that it was, you know, accounted for, and it didn't distract anyone from other objectives.
Yes. Keep the things going that are working and then have your test budgets on the
side. Absolutely. Absolutely.
Marnie, you've said so many great things about what businesses should do. And I know we could flip everything that you just said to say like, well, don't do the opposite of that. But is there anything else that in the, what they should absolutely not do and make it really clear as they grow their product business?
I'm going to say that you can't be everything to everyone. So be very mindful about product expansion. Don't try, like, people are going to try to convince you that you need to add different lines to your product offering. And that may be premature. It sounds good. There's a convincing argument to be made. How are you going to keep selling to your existing customers? Won't they want tank tops, panties, socks? You know, that's what I've been told, all of these things. And while it's true that I could see that Thigh Society would be offering this down the road, we've gotten to $20 million profitably without that, because we have continued to find different use cases for our existing product line that our customer believes in at the same time as finding new audiences. And that can be a more profitable road to success than taking a gamble on launching an entirely new line or launching three new product lines. So if you're absolutely going to do that and you are going to test and expand your product line, you know, at a point where you might be, everyone's always, of course, it's a gamble. Try to do it on a small scale. Try to do it with a test inventory, try to negotiate small minimum quantities just to test the market, test it with your VIP customers, survey people. I think it's just because product-based businesses are so cash heavy with inventory, especially if you're producing overseas and you're, you know, our lead times can be 6 months sometimes. So it's like, that's very difficult to anticipate ahead of 6 months ahead of time, your forecasting and what's going to, you know, what are people going to want? And how are we, do we have, how are we going to manage this? How are we going to manage our cash flow to put our down payments down and, you know, negotiating terms with your suppliers, et cetera. So I would say what not to do is don't expand too quickly. Don't believe the mindset that you have to expand your product offerings right out of the gate in order to keep your customer to come back and buy more. You can actually go deeper vertically in your business with what you're offering and the different, like I said, I keep saying it over and over again, but the different use cases and value props you can give to your customer rather than feeling this urge to branch out horizontally and, you know, try to offer her a whole bunch of other products that may not meet her needs as much as the one thing that you're doing now does.
Mm-hmm. I like that. Stay focused.
Stay focused. Yeah. Okay. Yeah.
Yes. And then all of the things that we just said to do, make sure that you're not doing them.
Yeah. Yeah. It's easy to flip both of them.
Exactly. Don't get caught by shiny objects, which is true for any entrepreneur.
It is. It's still tempting for me. You know, I think my CMO has like whipped me into shape over the last 3.5 years where I know now before I come to her with an idea that I better research it first before I even hint at the fact that I might want to try it. But you know, staying the course and staying focused can go a long ways away. It's a long ways to getting you towards your goals. And it's so easy to have FOMO in e-commerce because there's so many things happening at all times. And what works for one business may not work at all for another business. Focus on you, your value proposition that you offer your customers. How can you get them to keep buying from you and telling their friends about you and coming back for more? It's that simple at the end of the day.
One of the things I love most about what you've said today is really to not compare yourselves to the Walmarts or to the Amazons or to the whoever, depending on your product. Just be true to you and what you're trying to solve for your ideal customer. And that's it. Just do that.
Because they will understand your value. Like you said, when you had seen our ads, you knew right away we were speaking to you. Right. We know the pain points that we're trying to solve and we have honed in on who our customer is and we're constantly trying to find more customers, but we are remaining focused. And for me, especially as a founder, we can be so invested in our products and so passionate about what it is that we do, you know, in terms of the quality we're offering. And I could, you know, talk for hours about how our products are premium relative to some other subpar, cheap, disposable options that look like ours on the surface, but have, you know, don't use the same quality yarn, aren't made with the same, you know, fit and thoughtfulness and won't last as long and, you know, all the reasons. So you can't control what others are doing. You're never going to be able to compete with the Goliaths, but you don't need to compete with them. You just need to be the best that your customer wants and they will come back to shop with you, even if that means spending a little bit more to get the value out of what it is that you're selling, because they know that you are speaking to them in a way that those monoliths, you know, can't. They're not able to do that at such a huge scale, whereas you can.
Yes. And for those of you listening who haven't checked out Thigh Society, if you have any shape to your legs whatsoever, I think you definitely need to check out her brand, which we will have in the show notes. And I believe we also have your Instagram so they can follow you on social media as well. Yes. Any last words of advice for our women entrepreneurs listening today?
Last words of advice. Oh my gosh, there's so many. Be true to yourself. I know I said it before, but you know, just listen to yourself internally. What is it you are trying to build? Believe in yourself. Ask questions. Never be shy to ask questions. That's also, I think, really a strong piece of advice and one that I use. I even used it this morning. I asked someone to explain something to me as if I was 10 years old. And it doesn't matter if I'm the CEO and it doesn't matter how many years I've been running this business. If someone's explaining something to me and I don't understand it and it's going to have a repercussion implications to the business, I want to make sure I understand it. So if you have trouble understanding something, whether it's from a partner, a vendor, or an agency, someone trying to pitch you, keep drilling down until you're satisfied, because you're the one who gets to decide if you're ready to move forward with something, and chances are, especially with women, I find we don't always raise our hand. We're shy to raise our hand and say, I don't get it, because we think it's going to make us look stupid, but it's not. And if you have the question, chances are at least someone else in the room has the same question as you. So don't be afraid to speak up and use your voice and ask when something's not clear, and get that clarification so you can have the information you need.
Information is power.
It really
knowledge is power.
Knowledge is power. It's cliche for a reason, right?
It is. Well, I love the fact that you shared your knowledge with all of us today. I learned a lot. Our listeners learned a lot, I'm sure. And like I said, we'll have your socials to be able to follow you down this wonderful journey to your next big milestone.
Perfect. I look forward to that.
All right. Thanks again.
Thank you.
I hope you enjoyed today's episode. Please be sure to hit subscribe on your favorite podcast platform so you never miss an episode. The Woman Choosing Growth Show is not just another podcast. It's a tribe of women helping each other grow. So please share this podcast with all the women entrepreneurs that you would love to see succeed. If you'd like to know more about customized business advising through Cultivate Advisors, download business tools, or sign up for upcoming events, visit www.womenchoosinggrowth.com. Once again, that's www.womenchoosinggrowth.com. Remember, we are in this together. See you on the next one.